I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Do you have the time to listen to me whine about nothing and everything all at once? I am one of those melodramatic fools, neurotic to the bone, no doubt about it. Sometimes I give myself the creeps. Sometimes my mind plays tricks on me.
Oh, what you got there?
Caffeine-free Diet Coke.
Oh, you got one of them? I love a Diet Coke, okay. Yeah. Caffeine-free. Does it taste drastically different?
It tastes no different at all. They just, you know, just jacked up when you go to bed.
I gave up coffee because I used to do a breakfast show. And I'd get into work at about 6 a.m. and by 10, by the time the show finished, I'd be on like my third cup.
Oh, yeah.
Just tweaking out, and it, you know, became a bit of a disgusting habit.
It's not a good
habit. I switched for a herbal tea.
Okay.
Can we shut that door just to drown out the sound of your washing machine?
I should have figured that out. I should have thought that through.
Well, you're not an audio man, are you, Ian? So it's
understandable. So we want me just like that?
Yeah, mate. Okay. Wherever you're comfortable.
Right.
So it kind of seems fitting that we're doing this at your house because we're obviously going to talk about Punk, your new book, but we have here a Green Day t-shirt on. And
I see
the Green Day. Is it silver disc, platinum disc?
It's actually neither silver nor platinum. For the benefit of the listeners, I was sent this by Green Day's people or their record label, Warners, which is, you don't really see these anymore because records not selling these kind of quantities, but it's basically a like silver or platinum disc type. I'm not describing it very well.
It's a framed CD with a plaque.
A framed CD, and it has a plaque in it, and it says presented
to Ian
Winwood, which is me, to recognise sales in the United Kingdom of more than 1 million copies of the reprise album American Idiot in 2004. Above that, I'm looking a bit like a stalker.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even see that.
There's a framed picture of Green Day. That was taken by my dear friend and Kerrang legend, Paul Harries. That was taken 2 years ago in Mannheim in Germany. And if you turn your head 90 degrees and look above, there is a picture of,
it's like a shrine to Green Day,
a picture of Green Day that was taken again by Paul Harries. That was actually before American Idiot, and that was taken in Chicago, and they're all sitting in a, this is no good for audio, is it, but they're all sitting in an equipment truck there basically, and that was on the Pop Disaster tour. So yeah,
the guitar he's holding there, which is the guitar he had in the Basket Case video, does he use that at every gig, and has he used it since the 90s?
Yeah, I can actually tell you something a little bit about that for anyone that doesn't know. Can't picture it. It's a blue Fernandez Stratocaster copy, and on it has in red letters always the initials BJ.
Not blowjob, of course.
No, for Billy Joe. His mum bought him that when he was 9 years old.
Nine, wow.
And it is called Blue.
Right.
He has named it Blue, and it has been played in at least in part for every single Green Day concert the band has ever played, and Sweet Children concert, which is what they were called before Green Day. And actually, the picture that you see on the wall, as they were just kind of changing shots, he actually gave it to me to hold. And so I'm holding this guitar, and then Trey Cool, who's the band's drummer, picked up my phone and took a picture.
Love it.
Of me. And I
and that's framed by the bedside table.
I quite like this because I didn't ask to hold the guitar and I didn't ask for the photograph. It all happened around me. Yeah, so I'm quite pleased with that.
So let's talk about yourself, first of all, mate. Sure. So you're a long-time music journalist.
I would say it would appear so.
What was the driving force behind your choice to follow this career?
I'm not sure that I would call it a career. I've somehow kept my head.
Hey, you're still in the game.
I suppose that I am. It was really nothing more complicated than the fact that I was okay at school, but I just had a natural affinity for English and the written word, and I liked to write and I liked to read. And I still do.
Yeah, we've got a bookshelf full of books.
We've got
right
a bookshelf. We've got bookshelves behind us full of books, some of which I've even read, a couple of which I've written. And you know, I've been, as I look back on some of the things that I've been, you know, fortunate enough to do, that, you know, the travel, these Green Day pictures that we were talking about, I was there when both of those were taken. So I've been lucky enough to travel, but the best part of the gig for me was always. And always is the writing. It's the bit that I like the best, which is just as well, because many of the bits that were also perks of the job, such as travel,
free music,
travel and parties. I mean, music's free for everybody now.
Well, true, yeah.
But you know, music, parties, and travel, and yeah, you know, just sort of like a
thing of the past.
But a certain.
Grossness to it.
A certain status that you were sort of not quite a member of the general public. Yeah, it would be the best way to describe it, I guess. That doesn't sound, because any of us sound very good, but, you know, I'm on the guest list. There's a certain thing when you go to the show and go, oh, I'm on the guest list. And you always are. They've always put you on.
I still feel a bit cringe when I say that.
Okay.
When I go to venues, still.
Well, I mean, I suppose. I remember actually once. It depends if I'm reviewing the show or not. If I'm reviewing the show, I'm actually, as ridiculous as that job of work is, I'm actually doing a job of work. Sometimes I just go to because I can see a band and I know who's putting on the show, and that's, you know, I suppose, well, it is definitely a benefit of the job. It is worth pointing out that I'm sure when the revolution comes, I will be up against the wall for all of these things that I'm saying. I am always aware that this isn't free. People go, oh, I get to go to concerts for free. It's free for me. It's not free for the band. The band pays for that. So, and there are people out there who get their names on guest lists and then don't show up. And the band then pays for that seat or that space in the venue.
And if the guest list is full, that means that somebody who could have come and would have come. Yeah,
there's certainly that. So if I'm on a list, I do show up. I would like that to be taken into consideration before being sentenced.
It's on record.
Before being sentenced by a jury of my peers. But yeah, basically, it was no more. To go back to the question you asked me 25 minutes ago, Matt, I was a paper boy. Gosh, that makes me sound ill, doesn't it? And this magazine came into my paper bag one day called Kerrang! And I thought, oh my gosh, what's this? And it was like, well, it was like the moment in The Wizard of Oz where everything turns into colour. It was like, okay, this is, and my mum was very supportive. I said, I'd like to do this. And she said, well, you know, someone has to do it. I don't mean someone has to do it. Like,
it's a tough job,
yeah,
but someone's
has to claw in those chickens that are coming our way. And so that's where I followed it up. I was lucky that I spent my teenage years somewhat in the southeast in Buckinghamshire, so I had access to come to London to see shows.
Because
so,
we can hear from your dulcet tones, you're a man of the north.
I'm a man of the north, but my teenage years were actually spent in Buckingham. And the only thing that the rural setting for me has to recommend it, that one, is that it was within not far from touching distance, but you could get to London. It was feasible with a permissive mother and a sense of daring do to get down to. I mean, we're doing this interview from Camden Town, which is where I live, but we're just a short hop from the Electric Ballroom. And I remember coming to to Camden from school, literally from school, to go and see the Bad Brains.
On my own.
And I'd never heard them. I didn't even know that they were black. You know, this is before the internet. You just didn't know this stuff. And so enthused were people that I knew who had heard them. So I just came down. So I was aware that everything, certainly at the time, everything was in London, and the magazines were in London, and the shows that I went to were in London. So it was just a question of getting to London. So I came to London and got my first writing gig. There is actually a story behind that I read.
Yeah, I'm sure everybody would like to know how you went about breaking into the industry.
Well, I don't know if you if you look at something that you did as a younger person. I mean, you're a good example of this, Matt, because you're quite, and I mean this as a compliment, you're quite the hustler. And I'm not a very good hustler, but this is sort of an exception to the rule. And I remember it was January, and I'd only been in London a matter of a week or so, if not only a day or so. And I remember reading in Kerrang that an American metal band called Exodus, who were it not for the fact that Kirk Hammett, now of Metallica, was in their ranks, and the fact that their guitarist Gary Holt now deputizes in Slayer, they would kind of be a footnote. They were a very influential early day thrash metal band, but they never really delivered on their promise. But it reported that they were in London recording their debut album. It wasn't anything like their debut album. It was their fifth album. Sorry.
Their latest album.
Which emerged under the name Force of Habit. And then they revealed the name of the studio, which was Battery Studios, which is up in suburban northwest London. And I found out where the studio was, and it was just so cold. It was such a cold morning.
You remember it like it was yesterday.
Departed up to there, and at about 9:30, I went into the studio. And I explained who I was, and to the reception, people at reception, and said, oh, I'm hoping to get an interview to break into music journalism with the band. And very nicely.
So when you say you explained who you were, you're essentially a kid trying his luck.
A kid trying his luck, yeah. And they sent me away, but said, the band aren't here yet, but come back. And I learned the most important lesson that I've learned about the music industry, which is that people don't start work at 9:30 in the morning.
No.
But I did.
Michael Monroe does. Oh. He's the one exception to the rule.
Oh, okay. You would think that Michael Monroe would be the last exception to the rule.
I think back in the day would have been, but now he's obviously very clean, very sober, and I did a podcast with him at 9 a.m. Kensington as well, so I had to get up at about 7 to get down there.
From Birmingham, you had to come down.
I came down the night before.
All right, okay.
But yeah, he was there, fresh as a daisy, like Michael Monroe, fully in, you know, the costume, the look, everything, ready to go.
Right.
But for the large part, nothing happens before midday, does it?
So I came back a couple of hours later after having had a full English and by that point become extremely nervous. And there were Gary Holt, the aforementioned Gary Holt, and the guitarist at the time, Rick Honnold, who comprised the H Team, which for my money is the best guitar team in metal, I think, that I've ever heard. Certainly not the best songwriters, but the most effective guitar team. I'll stand by that.
And this is a man that's written books on Metallica.
Well, yeah, and they just play so well and so kind of searingly. And you have to remember as well, this is before, again, I'm making myself sound old, but this needs sort of, I think, stressing that I'd never heard these people speak before. Now, you know, that there are all
you
sorts.
Just go online. There are all sorts
of there are all sorts of YouTube channels. There are all sorts of means of communication that are making the craft of music journalism redundant for the most part. But these were people. These were, I guess, rock stars to me. That's perhaps not quite the right word, but they were people on the other side of the screen, on the other side of the magazine page, on the stage. You know, there was no sort of direct means of communication between me and them. The means of communication was through music journalism, and here I am suddenly with them. And it was quite a moment, and they very kindly gave me an hour of their time and an interview, and I came.
And that's a long time to give as well, even to a magazine, an hour's a long time.
It is a long time, and I wonder exactly what it was I was talking about, because I wouldn't take an hour now, if only for the hell of the transcription.
Yeah.
And I came back to where I was staying, and I had a little I had a little typewriter and I typed up and I wrote an interview from it. I wrote a little feature from it. And then there were far more music magazines in the city than there was Metal Forces and Rock Power and a couple of others, Metal Hammer, Kerrang.
And they were all print.
They were all print. Yeah. And I found out where each of these magazines came from. And was
Is that your cat?
Their officers, yes. That's my cat outside of the front door. Of their officers. And I hand-delivered my little feature round to all of the...
So did you scan and copy, or did you have to type it up several times?
No, I typed it on there. I think I had it photocopied. Shall I let my cat in?
Yeah, let's let him
let's
in.
Let him in.
Don't want to disclude him. Wants to be part of the action. He's a big boy, isn't he?
Yes, he's a...
He's a well-fed cat.
So, yes, so for the purposes, now I've let my... we are actually in my flat in Camden. We have my cat. He is the noisiest cat in the world, by the way. And that's what I did. And I got offers for work for two magazines. I took one of them, which was Metal Forces, which I took work on because it was a really strong underground metal mag. What I didn't know is that it was going through its death throes at the time. So I wrote for them for a year. There were three issues published of a monthly magazine. I wrote a good couple of £1,000 worth of work, for which I got paid £70 in the entire year.
No business like show business.
And I just thought that this is how magazines run. I mean, I didn't know anyone in the industry. That's the thing. I wasn't anyone's friend. I wasn't a friend of anyone, and I hadn't...
You didn't have a connected father or mother.
I had no connected. I was straight into it. And I just thought, how do people pay rent? How do people live or eat? How is this possible?
That's still the question I ask myself every week.
Yeah, and I guess we're sort of going back to that sort of chaotic model, but just on that magazine. So when I began to write for more established titles, and it took me a number of years to get onto Kerrang, and the time before that I would say were my apprenticeship years, but at least I was getting paid for it and I was making a living from it.
And as someone who loves the craft, you obviously, I presume, enjoyed the process of honing your craft.
I did, and I don't think that I knew that I was honing it now. I think I would shudder to read anything that I'd written before I got to Kerrang, and even some of the stuff at Kerrang, I probably would have difficulty reading now.
How many years have you been writing for the publication?
For Kerrang, 20 years. 19, but 20 next year.
Wow.
I know. With a year off where I was poached by the enemy, and then I went back to Kerrang. It wasn't to my liking.
Right.
Really.
Did you ever write for Metal Hammer? Have you ever written
for them? Oh, yeah, lots of times. And in fact, for a short time, I was the features editor on Metal Hammer. Metal Hammer's a fine publication. It was me that was the problem there, because I'm just not really a metalhead.
Right. So punk is first and foremost your love, within this specific genre.
And don't get me wrong, there are metal bands that I love. I love Slayer. I love Motorhead, I love Metallica, but all of them sort of have that punk thing within them.
Yeah.
I'm really too much of a snob to really gumby down with the good old boys of metal. And so it was my problem. It was my problem at the Hammer, that it was an awkward fit. But yes, I was features editor there for a year. And it just really wasn't. I mean, I like, for anyone who doesn't know, the term Kerrang, the name Kerrang, is an onomatopoeic word.
It's the
sound of a guitar being struck with force. Kerrang. So in my time at Kerrang, I've interviewed loads of people, but a number of whom you would never ever describe as being metal. So the White Stripes, for example, these are the better known ones. The White Stripes, the Chili Peppers, Muse, the Beastie Boys.
What's been some of your favourites over the years? If you could handpick a couple. Obviously, you pretty much interviewed everyone.
On a couple of occasions.
Who stands
out?
But
not Maiden, oddly enough.
Wow.
Not Maiden.
Never interviewed
Maiden, and I don't know why.
I'd like to have Bruce on this podcast. I think he'd be an interesting guest.
He'd be fantastic. You could ask him why he voted Brexit.
Yep.
as the world.
Tally ho,
yes, as the world. Yes, we won a war, don't you know? Who's this we exactly, Bruce? Because I didn't. I'm pretty sure you weren't there. I once got the Beastie Boys to dance for me.
Amazing.
It was in New York, and
what album are they on at this point?
They were just releasing, or just about to release, To the Five Boroughs.
Great record.
So they've been away for 5 years.
Open Letter to NYC samples the Dead Boys, of course.
Yeah, that's one of the better songs on the album. I think it's perhaps a little bit stilted. Anyway, it doesn't really matter what I think of it. And we're in this brownstone down in Chelsea in New York. And it was just me and them in this quite small little office, smaller than the room that we're in now. And just to get things going, there was no way any of this was going to go into print, but just as a first question, I said, you know, you've been away for a long time. What have you been up to? And they said, we got kidnapped by Sasquatch. Sasquatch, I learned, is what we call Bigfoot.
Yeah.
And I said, okay, really? And they said, yeah. And I said, oh, how was that? And they said, oh, it was okay. He taught us loads of stuff, loads of things. And I said, well, such as what? And they said, oh, he taught us how to dance. And I said, show me. Okay, show me. Now, not only two of the three did it. Horovitz, who is my favourite Beastie Boy, didn't stand up. But Adam Yauch and Mike Diamond got up and just started dancing, as they do in a Beastie Boys video.
Yeah. Like
Intergalactic.
Like Intergalactic
style. Yeah, exactly, like Intergalactic. Yeah. And they're going... And I'm sat there in this wood-lined, little, tiny little office thinking, the Beastie Boys are dancing for me. And it's important to say that there are so many things musically that I've been on the wrong side of, and so many things that I didn't recognise as being great until it was too late. I'm really not a very good bellwether at all, but I did get it right.
You've got two cats.
I've got two cats. This is Durf Scratch who's coming in.
Durf Scratch is that his name?
And the other one's Chuck Wagon. But I did buy Paul's Boutique on the day it came out, and I recognised it at the time as being a significant work of genius.
Even the hip hop guys at that time were, I think, taken aback by the level of sampling and artistry in that album.
Just it's just for anyone. I mean, it's difficult now, of course. I actually played it for my girlfriend who'd never heard it before. It doesn't sound as revolutionary as it did at the time, but at the time it's a record made up entirely of other records,
yep,
and them sampling and them rapping over the top. But as a means of escaping from the, from the corner into which they'd painted themselves on license.
That kind of frat rock.
Yeah, you know, they sold, in the state, 7 million copies. So maybe, 12 million copies throughout the world of that bratish. They could not have been less credible as a group in the eyes of serious music people.
And the imagery was a big part of that, wasn't it? With the big V-dub badge chains, and it was all... it's still a great record, I think. But yeah, it certainly did pigeonhole them.
Very much so, yeah. And that it had One Hit Wonder written all over it. And here they come back with Paul's Boutique, and it's suddenly... I mean, it died on its derriere.
No doubt.
At the time. Yeah. I mean, I think it went gold in the States, but that's not what Capitol Records were looking for, their new home. And they were able to regroup and then return with License, Check Your Head, and then Ill Communication.
What a run.
Yeah, it really was. But so I sort of got that right. So to be in a room and you just think, well, the Beastie Boys are dancing for me, that's quite cool. But you know,
they're the moments that you cherish. Do you cherish those moments and realize that you're privileged to be in that position?
Yes, I do.
Pinch yourself almost.
I do. Although I think that
I know you're not someone who gets starstruck or
not particularly. I don't want to be friends with them either. That's never really been of interest to me.
Again, going back to that thing of you're there to do your job, which is to document, review.
Yeah, for what it's worth, and this sounds very pompous, but I'll stand by it. My responsibility is to whoever's reading the piece, And given that I don't know who's reading the piece, it's me who's reading it once I've written it. My responsibility is to myself. I'm not being paid by the bands. I'm not their PR. I'm not there to be on their side.
Has that got you in trouble over the years?
Yeah, quite a few times. Interestingly, one of the people with whom I am friends is Frank Turner, which you're listeners may know as a...
He's been on the show. Yeah, he's coming on again soon. I'm going to record a chat with him in Waterstones in Birmingham when you're on the tour with him.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I'll see you then.
Well, yes, you're hosting them all. I am indeed. I'm his interrogator on a tour we're doing next week.
Because he did the book Q&A for you, didn't
he? Did at Rough Trade, yeah. I remember giving a really cool review to his album Tape Deck Heart, which actually is, I was wrong about it. I was a bit, and taking real pleasure in sort of being damning with faint praise about it. Because it sort of said to me, oh, well, the fact that I'm on good terms with him isn't colouring what I'm writing.
Did it affect the friendship at all, or did he?
He never mentioned it, which is, I think, one of the reasons why we're friends. Actually took me to mention it a couple of years later, but a couple of people sort of around him said at the time, "Oh, you know, we thought you were a friend."
Yeah,
and it's like, well, I am, but that doesn't give you carte blanche for me.
You're not above criticism.
No, really, and I feel uncomfortable even saying all of this, because as if somehow, you know, my own integrity matters, but it matters to me.
You.
Yeah. And also it matters that...
Well, good on you, man, because that's a rare thing in today's journalistic world,
To the best of my ability, I at least try to be an honest broker. You know, you look back at magazines over the years and you see great reviews for bands, you know, Maiden, for example. Maiden released some terrible albums in the 90s, and even some of them in the 80s, and 5Ks in Kerrang, because it was all sort of this drinking,
because they want them to still be the cover stars as well.
And it was all sort of this drinking club as well. It was a bit corrupt, and I try, to the best of my ability, I try to stay out of that, if that matters to me, at least.
That segues nicely into the book then, because the opening foreword is from Frank. It says, the only thing that punk rock should ever really mean is not sitting around and waiting for the lights to go green.
That's right.
Off Try This at Home. And then the book itself is a book about the 90s explosion of punk rock. I wonder if we could talk about what that scene and style of music means to you from a personal point of view, and then going into the book, why you chose this specific time period to explore.
Yeah, I picked this time period because the book's called Smash, Smash with an exclamation mark, and it takes its title sort of from the Offspring album Smash without an exclamation mark that was released in April of 1994, and which, along with Green Day's Dookie album, broke the glass ceiling that separated punk rock from the mainstream. And when I say punk rock, I mean bands that identified as punk rock. Not Nirvana, not Soundgarden, not Pearl Jam, not Alice in Chains, not Smashing Pumpkins, although a punk rock spirit...
pervades through all of those.
All definitely. Of those, and it would, and only an idiot. But they don't...
The success of those bands was arguably as well, I guess, what paved the way, right, for the success of Green Day,
yes,
Offspring, etc.
It did, but, I'm old enough to remember the sort of frenzy of adoration and opprobrium that the music press bestowed on the bands from the Pacific Northwest
and continue to do.
But Nirvana were the good guys. I mean, it really was sort of like they hounded Kurt Cobain in the way that the mainstream media hounded Princess Diana, really. Yeah. I mean, it really was quite something to see. Every week, Nirvana on the cover of Sounds, The Melody Maker, The Enemy, which were selling 300,000 copies a week. This is mind-boggling figures today, really. They are nothing selling anything like that. and you know, Nirvana were the good guys and Pearl Jam were the bad guys. And how ridiculous does that now seem?
Well, there's that interesting scene in, is it 10, the documentary?
Yeah.
And they're sort of saying how actually the people around Nirvana were the gross kind of corporate.
Yeah.
And Pearl Jam were actually quite punk rock in their approach and in their attitude.
Yeah.
And
I mean, Pearl Jam didn't make any videos after 10. Yeah. And anyway, and it was such a frenzy that by the time it ended in, and it ended with Kurt Cobain's suicide in April of 1994, the press had exhausted itself, you know, lobbing around superlatives. And so the attention paid to Green Day and The Offspring and bands who were defined themselves as punk rock bands and who had been doing this thing, touring in vans and you know,
just doing the Black Flag way.
Yeah, just having this self-sufficient scene, its own record labels, Lookout Records up in the Bay Area, Epitaph Records down in the San Fernando Valley in LA and Orange County. Sort of, even when they went supernova and were selling millions and millions of copies, The Offspring were still kind of a part-time band, you know, and they did virtually no press. Green Day did very little press. I mean, Green Day did a lot of videos and were on MTV a lot, and The Offspring were on MTV a lot. But not much changed other than everything else around them. They were just sort of like, and they retained to me this feeling that they were underdogs.
Proudly so as well.
Yeah, and I just thought, and I still think, that much of the music about which I'm writing in the book, so whether it be Social Distortion, whether it be Bad Religion, No Effects, Rancid, Green Day, all of those bands, perhaps with the exception of Green Day, because of course American Idiot did give them their due, but that was 10 years after 10 to 15 years after the period about which I'm writing in the book. I just thought this was sort of a story of underdogs and that hadn't quite been given its moment in the sun.
Yeah, it's not been told in this level of detail or depth before, certainly.
No. And that was why, and I just thought, I think I can get a story out of this. And it is with my tongue in my cheek, but nonetheless, it's possibly fair to say that I might just qualify as a punk rock insider in the fact that I've interviewed all of the bands numerous times. Rancid were the only group that didn't come out and play, if you'll excuse the pun. But I've even interviewed Rancid a number of times.
Do they just not do it? Are they just,
they
not
just don't do
still
anything
now?
Anymore. And I used all sorts of little avenues. I didn't just go to their manager anything. And actually, funnily enough, I actually did meet their manager.
Who's that, Dan Hodge?
He manages the Interrupters, right, at an Interrupters show at the Electric Ballroom here in Camden. And he was really nice, and I thought, you know what, if I had met you, you might have been able to make an appeal on my behalf. But I tried all sorts of routes.
As I do with this podcast, I know the ways around things to try and get
that's right
the access.
And usually it works. Usually, but I mean, I couldn't. It was as if they were dead, Matt. But everyone else,
they assumedly approved of their inclusion in the book, though they didn't want to not be involved.
I have no idea.
I love it.
That wouldn't make any difference. I mean, if they said we don't want to be in it, that wouldn't have made any difference to me. It's not their business to tell me what I can and can't.
Punk rocker.
But I was able to get everyone else. And again, given that I'm saying a few pompous things on this interview, I wanted to write a book that was sort of like a big New Yorker article, really, about a seemingly slight subject that which isn't slight to me, you know, about this collection of misfits who somehow ended up in the top 10. All of the bands that featured ended up at least with gold albums in the United States, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is albums that sell more than 500,000 copies. And none of them seemed particularly to be looking for it, you know? Many of them did it on independent labels, And I just thought it was a cool little story to tell. So you know, that's what I did. And I sat down to it over the winter of 2017, 2018, and into the spring and summer with rewrites and edits and tightening up and whatnot. It's quite a lot of work goes into a book. And it's coming. It's just come out. And I am particularly proud of it.
It's a great book, mate. Yeah, and it's really nice to see this subject being given its due by somebody who's so well informed and clearly passionate about it.
Right, thank you.
The way you talk about certain songs, I've never heard, you know, the music of, say, The Offspring or NOFX be evaluated in the way that you get into in this book as well, which is really refreshing.
Okay, well, thank you for that, Matt. It was a strange thing to do because...
The social commentary, for instance, if you could lead into that as well, in The Offspring's music.
Yeah.
Which many people, I'm sure, would have never thought about or taken the time to appreciate.
No, and it's strange as well. I mean, music really is, popular music particularly, really is an amazing Trojan horse for sneaking in things of substance. But it's such a good Trojan horse that if the song's too catchy, it's possible to go years, decades, or even forever without really considering what the song's about. Elvis Costello's Oliver's Army is a peach of a pop song that features references to Palestine and Johannesburg and Winston Churchill. And you could just happily sing along without noticing that.
And the N-word
as well, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he refused to take that out for release in the United States. All it takes, one itchy trigger, one more widow, one less white nigger, is the line. Yeah, but there you go, singing along to the song. And similarly with The Offspring's Come Out and Play, Keep Them Separated, which is, I think, an incredibly sophisticated song. And it was written by Dexter Holland, who was at university at USC, University of Southern California, on a campus that was... In order to get to the campus, he had to drive through Compton and Watts, which certainly at the time in the early 90s were not...
We're talking the age of gangster rap.
We're talking the age of the LA riots.
Yep.
To
Bloods and Crips.
Bloods and Crips. You know, these were dangerous neighborhoods. And he wrote a song about the cheapness of life in neighborhoods such as that. But what I found particularly striking is that he harvested the material for the lyric simply by driving through these neighborhoods in his crappy car,
a white college kid with dreadlocks.
Like. Yeah, but who wasn't a car so crappy that no one paid him any mind, and that's sort of the perspective of the song. It is at a journalistic distance
observation.
Yeah, yeah, and I thought that was very good. He's not bemoaning. He's not taking the stage, center stage, in a story in which he does not himself belong. And I thought that was I'm not sure I thought it at the time. I'm not sure I noticed it at the time. I knew what the song was about. But as I sort of listened to it to articulate what it was I liked about it, that was the thing, this tasteful distance. You know, it's not up in the faces or in the lives of people whose lives he doesn't recognize. And I thought that was very clever. What the listener hears, and I don't think the song is lessened if the impact of the song or the appreciation of the song is any less if one doesn't consider that angle. It's just a fantastic caffeinated pop song.
With its Eastern flavour.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very unusual.
Yeah,
isn't it?
It's slightly Egyptian, yeah. almost guitar motif. And they wrote this, and Brett Gurewitz at Epitaph hired for the first time ever a radio plugger, and he played this radio plugger $60,000, and then suddenly it's on K-Rock, which is being played on K-Rock, which is the leading alternative rock radio station in LA, and thus by extension America. And also it's picked up by MTV, who are showing a video that cost $5,000 to film in a friend's garage, or garage, as they would say. The majority, the heft of the budget was spent on food for the barbecue and beer for the barbecue afterwards. And yet suddenly there they are.
And obviously that then led to that album becoming
the first independent album in history, right?
Yeah, the first independent, and it remains, it was the most successful independent album of all time. That has since been usurped by Adele.
Oh, has it? Right.
Yeah, and other people too. It remains the best-selling rock release.
And it was the first to tip the million sales point.
Oh, yeah, and you know, it was doing, you know, 100,000 copies a week. It's worth bearing in mind that Epitaph before that point had only sold 100,000 copies of any one artist, and that was Bad Religion, who were there before The Offspring, their commercial gold standard. The label would have ice cream cake parties for any band that sold 50,000 copies. The label's owner, Brett Gurewitz, who also plays in Bad Religion, defined that as punk rock gold.
Yep.
If a punk rock album sells 50,000 copies, that is
the highest achievement.
That is the equivalent of, I don't know, Bush, for example, or any other band around that time, selling 500,000 albums. So that would, they'd have, although you wouldn't get a gold disc for 50,000 albums, you would get an ice cream cake party and all the other bands would come along. And the reason that they did that is because it was just beyond his imagination or comprehension that any act on his label would actually sell proper gold. And yet suddenly here they were now shifting in the millions of sales. And he stayed independent. So
that's what I love about it, is obviously he got courted. And how much did he get offered? Millions, right?
Sony Records, or the Sony Corporation, offered him 55-0. And bearing in mind, this is 1994 as well. $50 million for a minority stake in the company.
Oh, wow. So not even the whole thing?
No, 49%. And it's also worth noting that he was on taking crack and heroin and cocaine and anything else he could get his hands on at the time. And he had the good sense to turn this down. So
because of his sense of pride and achievement, and
I think that was part
integrity
of it. I think that was part of it. I think, you know, from what I can infer, from what I can deduce, that was part of it. Largely significantly as well, just a sense of opposition that he didn't perhaps want to be in any club that would have him as a member. The majors had ignored the entire scene for certainly a good 5 years, you know. They were very late to the party. It wasn't like the Pacific Northwest where they got involved quickly and smartly. They were very late to the party. They were remiss. And he thought, well, we've done okay without them. Let's see how far we can ride. We'll ride this thing until the wheels fall off. And I just don't think he needed them, really. And there were people around the
Which is an achievement as well, isn't it? Because you talk in the book about how they actually kept up with this, you know, surge in sales.
Yeah, just the practicalities, Matt, of what 100,000 CDs and albums looks like. You know, where do you put those?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, so they were hiring warehouse spaces all over the city, guarding pallets, just the, you know, the sheer mechanics of those kind of numbers, because they didn't have that. You know, major labels have warehouses in which to store,
and a staff to obviously
physical and a distribution system. It's a well-oiled machine selling, you know, for I don't know what 94, what else is big in 94 that was, so, you know, Green Day on a major, on Warner Brothers have the facilities to sell, you know, that many albums. They have it on all major labels do, whether it be the Smashing Pumpkins, whether it be Michael Jackson, whether it be Mariah Carey, you know, whoever's selling Hootie and the Blowfish, they have the space. And indie doesn't do that. And indie's just in time supply.
Yeah.
And yet there they were, and they duked it out with the big boys, and they held their own.
Let's talk about NOFX and obviously Fat Mike and his role in Epitaph, but then obviously, I guess, inspired by the model and by Brett's ethos towards making and releasing music.
Yeah.
He then set up his own independent label called Fat Records. From speaking to both of them, did you feel like there was a fallout at any point?
The idea of a punk rock record label isn't new, and it didn't start with Epitaph.
Where would you say it did start, with Discord? Or even before then?
Before then.
Well, I guess in the UK anyway, Buzzcocks.
The Buzzcocks released Spiral Scratch. That was the Spiral Scratch EP in 78, 78?
I think 77.
77.
Yeah, it was the first indie label in the UK.
That was the first ones to do it. But yeah, you're right. There was Discord in Washington, D.C. There was SST down in Los Angeles. Black Flag. Guitarist Greg Ginn established that. Solid State Transmitters, I think SST stands for.
I never even knew that.
Up in San Francisco, you had, of course, Alternative Tentacles, which was the label Jello, founded by Jello Biafra and the Dead Kennedys. So this wasn't new. I mean, in so much as there has been a fallout between Fat Mike and and Brett Gurewitz, Brett's utterly mystified by what it might be. Fat Mike seems to think, and it's really nothing more than this, and there are a couple of beefs in the book. There's a beef between The Offspring and Epitaph, and The Offspring leaving Epitaph to go to a major. And there's Fat Mike appears disgruntled that Mr. Brett didn't support the foundation of Fat Mike's record label, Fat Records, Fat Records, is how it's written down. But with all of the little minor flare-ups that I write about in the book, in hindsight, no one can really seem to remember what they were about. And Fat Mike's sort of displeasure came from an interview that he'd read a couple of days previous to me talking to him.
Right, okay. And it was fresh.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that he would have brought that up. I mean, he is generous enough to say that Mr. Brett is the best writer in punk rock, the best songwriter in punk rock, and he might be onto something there.
I heard Tim Armstrong on Toby Morse from H2O's podcast very recently, and he was saying that he regards Brett as the best producer in punk rock as well.
Okay, right.
He's done every Rancid album ever, right?
No, he hasn't. He didn't do an Outcome the Wolves.
Did he not do an Outcome the Wolves?
No, he didn't.
I stand corrected.
It will come, Jerry
Finn. That's the best one. Oh yeah,
Finn.
That was his first album,
yeah,
right?
It was. Yeah. Jerry Finn, who mixed Dookie. He did do some of the work on Outcome the Wolves, uncredited, but because there was a studio clash, a schedule clash,
and
the sessions overran.
But he's certainly been their guy.
Very
the
much
whole
so.
Time,
yeah,
right?
Very much so. And so I don't think. I mean, Mr. Brett did point out that Fat Mike is possibly the only person in punk rock who has taken more drugs than he has. So how reliable Fat Mike's memory is possibly open to question. It's nothing.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend, John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And let's talk about the role of Rob Cavallo.
Yeah, I mean, Rob Cavallo, it is the strangest thing, just how on tiny incidents, you know, matters of great significance hinge. The reason that Smash, the album, sounds so good is because Dexter Holland insisted that the band buy better equipment. They were able to do so because they came back from a European tour with NoFX with $750. Without that, how would the album have sounded? Probably not that good. Would it have sold any copies? Probably not. Rob Cavallo was a young A&R representative of Warner Brothers Records, as well as a producer for the label. He was in the studio in Los Angeles producing the first album he's ever produced, which is a self-titled album by LA's very much...
one of the best, most underrated punk bands ever.
Yeah, one of the very, very best and very, very much pop.
Yeah, yeah.
Pop punk.
Ramones-esque, isn't it?
Ramones-esque, the Muffs. And the Muffs were managed by two men who had just taken on Green Day. They had a demo tape. They put it in Rob Cavallo's pocket or on the mixing desk and said, you know, listen to this, you might like it. And it was only out of a sense of duty. See, he certainly didn't want to. It was in the wee hours of the morning. He's driving back from the Music Grinder studio in Los Angeles. And he's going to, and he's driving home. And he puts this tape in, and it's got some of the songs that would make up Dookie. And he's just so captured by what he hears. I think Longview was on there. I think Basket Case was on there. Maybe even When I Come Around. Maybe the big hit singles, Burnout, I think, was on there. And from that, he lobbied hard from a very lowly position. And this needs remembering as well, that The idea that an A&R man, a 20-something A&R man, would go to a major record label. Record labels have deeply hierarchical structures. Very low down on the totem pole, would go to his superiors and say, I want to sign a punk rock band. That doesn't suggest a man whose finger is on the pulse at all. And the turnover in these companies, certainly at the time, was very, very quick, you know. Yet he went to bat for this band, and they say he signed Green Day, and they liked him. And, you know, to cut a long story short, he's produced, you could say, all the Green Day albums of note. He didn't produce 21st Century Breakdown, which I think is a criminally underrated album. But he produced Dookie, he produced Insomniac, he produced Nimrod, he produced American Idiot, yeah. And what's more, he's just the most amazingly stand-up guy you could ever meet. He could not have been more helpful to me in the book. And
did he later on go on to do the massive My Chemical Romance album, The Black Parade?
He did The Black Parade, yeah, which wasn't quite as massive as you think it is.
Was it not?
Few million albums, but nothing like American Idiot,
right.
Or anything like that. American Idiot was the last great blockbusting rock album. But interestingly, excuse me, Kerrang, as a cover, ran as a cover story, the story of Dookie, which I wrote. This is at the start of February.
Because it's obviously 25 years as well, 25
years,
perfectly timed.
Amazing,
book, isn't it?
Yeah, 25 years. I mean, where does the time go? And they wanted clearance on a photograph on which Rob holds the copyright. So I sent him a text saying, oh, hi, Rob, is there any chance we could use this photo? And he went, yeah, of course you can. I'm just on my way to Atlanta. I'm doing the sound for the Super Bowl halftime show, you know, so, yeah.
Big boy business.
This is right. This is not the minor leagues. So it worked out for him as well. Also, he didn't charge a fee for producing Dookie. He got points because he wanted to keep the recording caps down, which is one of the smartest decisions anyone's ever made, because it, you know, sold what, 15, 17 million copies, and he got a cut of every single one of those. So yeah, it was wise.
I'd love to talk to you all day, mate. I know on the subject of punk, you have an article to write.
I am the godfather
of punk himself.
I am three quarters away. Just to set the scene for the listener. Do you call them listeners on podcast, audience?
Yeah, they're listeners. They're
disciples.
Listening. Hopefully they're listening. Disciples.
Disciples.
We can dream.
Matt came to the door. This has been on the docket for some time. And Matt came to the door, and I really was just hammering away at my keyboard. Yes, I have a looming deadline about John Lydon, with whom you and I have both had encounters.
Yes.
Yours was good.
Mine was fantastic.
I've had two. The first one was horrible, and the second one was he was a sweetheart, and I'm not sure which put me on edge the most.
Because you did an interview, right? And the first one was basically unusable, was it? So you arranged another one?
He was like... I mean, if you encountered someone in the street carrying on like that, you'd ring the authorities.
Yeah, I mean, he
was like a mad pensioner.
Which is kind of what he is now.
Yeah, and
I still rate him very highly.
I know you do. My brief has been Johnny Rotten, punk or not.
It would have been good to have been in that room. So well, if anybody hasn't seen this, there was a live Q&A in LA a couple of days ago, and it was Henry Rollins, Duff McKagan, Danita from L7, Marky Ramone, and John Lydon, and John Varvatos, because it's to celebrate this new punk documentary that him and Iggy have made. And it's basically Marky Ramone and John just going loggerheads, isn't it? Just going at it.
Yeah.
and Rollins and Duff just kind of look bemused, don't they?
Have you
seen all the videos?
Yeah, I have, yeah. And of course he's still punk. And the reason he's still punk is because if you just take the art, if you just take him out of it, what remains is the music. If you do the same with Marky Ramone, what is Marky Ramone doing? He's taking around a facsimile of Ramone's songs, many of which he didn't even play on, at clubs like the Underworld here in Camden. And it's nice if you want it, but it's not.
It ain't revolutionary.
It's nothing. It's no different from, you know, the bands from the 70s playing Weekenders at Butlin's, which my mum goes to, and she loves it, and there's nothing wrong with that, but let's not pretend it's anything of particularly revolutionary significance.
And of course, the Ramones definitely had a key role in the English punk scene, and a lot of bands seeing them, like the Clash, Pistols,
at the Roundhouse,
and being inspired to start their own music.
Totally.
But, as you say, he wasn't on those first four albums.
No, he wasn't. And it's
although he was in the Richard Hell and Voidoids, which is clear to point out in the video.
Yes, he was in Richard. But you know, Pill have put out, I think, two albums in the last few years, both of which are flat out cutting edge weird.
Yep.
You know, there is a beating punk heart, if you want to call it that, an oppositional creative heart still beating within Lydon for all of the rubbish that he talks when people stick microphones in front of his face. If you listen to the body of work, I'll go to bat for that any day.
Amen.
Yeah.
Can we end on the Nickelback story? Chad Kroeger, can we entertain our listeners with the tale of when you and Chad almost had a boxing match?
Yeah, I'll do this quite quickly because I have told it before, but my reputation, such as it is, my name, I suppose, was made by an article that I wrote about Nickelback after an interview in Philadelphia that had gone particularly poorly. Where questions that I thought were only mildly, not even confrontational, probing about the fact that Nickelback are quite a reactionary music force and quite just not very good, really. But the thing is, if you ask artists that, sometimes they, in fact, most times, they quite like being challenged and quite like defending themselves. So it's difficult questions often make for easier interviews.
It goes back to what you were saying at the start as well about wanting to do the feature justice. And you know for a fact that your readers are interested in what he sees as the musical worth of his band Nickelback.
That's right. And so the interview goes incredibly badly. the band are... This took place in Philadelphia, and the band are performing at a charity concert, a radio station Christmas charity concert, on a five-band bill, of which they are fourth bottom to the bill. So they're only second on. Above them are Sum 41, Bush, and then Blink-182 are the headliners.
So not even good bands above them.
No, not particularly. And they put, you know, it was at the what is now, I think, called the Wells Fargo Arena. It's where the Philadelphia 76ers and the Flyers ice hockey team play. So it's a big old arena. They come on. Most of the crowd are cheering, apart from one member. A couple are booing, don't get me wrong. And there's one guy at the front who's holding up his middle fingers to Chad Kroeger instead of putting them in his ears. And I just... And this Nickelback at the end of the song Chad insists that this kid gets thrown out or removed. I'm not sure to be perfectly accurate. I'm not sure what he had in mind, thrown out or removed. Oh, and if that's a distinction without a difference, what he did threaten to do was leave the stage unless this happened, because the security just were like, what? This isn't our job to throw a kid out. He's not harming anyone. He's not posing any kind of threat.
So he stopped the gig, did he?
I don't know. He threatened to walk off the stage, right, unless the kid was removed. He waited till the end of the song before. And I just sort of watched all this going down. And it wasn't just me. My friend Paul Harries, who we've just talked about at the start, at the top of the show, after he'd shot this, came back to me and went, fucking hell, did you see that? And it's like, that's my impression of an Essex accent, by the way. Fucking, did you see that? And I said, yeah. So it wasn't just me that thought, well, that was peculiar. And it just provided me with the intro for this piece. And I just wrote for anyone, described what had happened. And I said, for anyone not employed by or in love with Nickelback, the message is clear. New sentence, Chad Kroeger, colon, what a cunt. and then a break between that. Between that and the second section. So it just hangs there.
And you can say the C word in print, can you?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and this is the thing. If would I write that today? Probably not. No, I probably wouldn't showboat in that way. I was quite a yappy little writer back then. I suppose I would defend it for one reason, in that...
It was playful as opposed to attacking. Or was it attacking?
I went on
from
to...
What place were you coming from?
I went on to attack the band, I think, substantively, as to the best of my ability at the time. Later, that was just me having fun, I think. But what it did is, I remember writing it thinking, well, they're not going to print that. They're not going to run with that.
And so you just chanced it. You weren't certain that they would.
I was certain they wouldn't.
Right.
And they did. So that's, if anybody that wants to do this for a living or just for the fun of it, don't censor yourself. Wait till someone else says change that. Don't assume that you're not going to get away with something. Chances are you're not, but you never know. And that was the case, that you never know. And anyway, the upshot of all this is that Chad challenged me to, not pleased by what I'd written, Chad challenged me to a boxing match from the stage, by name, from the stage at every arena in their UK tour of
every single city,
every single city, yeah. and I said, yeah, sure.
Were you at any of these shows, or did you just hear it on the grapevine?
I heard the next morning. In fact, when they played Wembley Arena, I went to see, with my friend Dan, where I went to see West Ham play. So it wasn't until the next morning even that I found out all of this stuff. And, Kerrang were scouting out locations that this might happen. I learnt, if anybody wants to put on a boxing match, you actually don't need a license. You just need a doctor there on hand in case, I get...
You were fully intending to go through with it. You were up for it.
I'm not sure I was fully intending to go through with it. I said that I would, and I would have done it had it come to it. When nothing came of it, I didn't go, when's this happening? What's going on? I'm really keen to get this going. I was quite happy to let it die a sad and lonely death. But just for the record, I said I would fight him. God, I hope I'm not digging this up now. I said I would fight him. The ball remained in his corner. I'm really mixing my sporting metaphors here, Matt. And nothing came of it. So,
other than, a lot of hype.
And
perhaps attention.
Yeah, yeah. And it sort of...
Which is... Maybe helped a little bit along the way.
A little bit. It took a little while to get rid of the reputation of that's all that I did.
Going around
the world insulting people.
Yeah.
But that is sometimes part of what I do. So, I'll take it.
Love it. Well, mate, so good to see you.
Thank you, Matt. Thanks, everyone. Thank you for coming around. It's Matt's birthday today as well, everybody. All the threes.
The big 3-3 three that you said isn't that big, isn't it?
It's not that big. Not when I'm about to send the big 4-8.
I just want to say the book is out now. It's called Smash. And if you like Green Day, Offspring, Bad Religion, No Effect, Rancid, etc., you definitely need to buy it. I've brought mine. Can you sign it?
Yeah, of course I can.
Ian, you take care. I'll see you in Birmingham with Frank for the book tour that he's going to be putting on. And you've also got two Metallica books out as well, if people want to read those.
I do. Written with my friend Paul Branigan. The first one's titled Birth School Metallica Death, and the second one's titled Into the Black, and they're published by Faber and Faber. Much to my surprise, published by Faber and Faber. Truth be told, only the second one's worth buying.
There you go, an honest man. And what's next for you?
I have no idea.
Other than this John Lydon article.
This John Lydon article. Maybe something about mental health.
Yeah, okay, yeah. A full book.
Yeah, but I'm putting together a proposal at the moment.
Great.
So ask me in a month.
All right, mate. Okay. Well, all the best. And yeah, good to see you.
Thank you, everyone.
You gotta keep them separated.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.